was an Oberlin College undergraduate of the class of 49 and majored in economics, and then I went to Princeton University to get an MA in 1951 and a PhD in 1957 in economics.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got my further education at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
When did you start at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York?
In 1951.
So you were at the New York Fed for a while and then you went back?
No, I worked throughout that period at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, writing my thesis while I was working.
Mm-hmm.
And that is described in my memoirs, which I've offered to send you. And
yes,
you can certainly make a copy of those relevant pages in the memoirs.
Well, okay, so let's talk for a while now, but I expect that I'll have more questions after I've read your memoirs.
Uh-huh.
This is actually important because the Korean War broke out in June of 1950 and the accord was signed in March of 1951. So when did you start work at the New York Fed? What month, do you remember?
Yes, I think it was July 15, 1951.
Mm-hmm. And when you read what Ralph Leach and I wrote, we emphasize the fact that the accord gave the Fed power to move interest rates, but the issue of where the locus of power was going to be within the Federal Reserve System wasn't settled. And Sproul thought that the New York Fed should again be the preeminent center within the Federal Reserve System because that's where open market operations were conducted and that's where the money market was. And Sproul and Rosa and the other people of the New York Fed thought that you needed to follow the psychology of the markets and you couldn't do that unless you were right there where the markets were. Of course, William McChesney Martin had a very different idea. He believed that the locus of power within the Federal Reserve System should be in Washington, supported by the regional bank presidents and a federal system that reached throughout the United States, and that if you were going to have that kind of a system, then you couldn't follow the markets, the market psychology in a close way. You would just transact in treasury bills and let the rest of the term structure be determined kind of by the market. And he was supported by a young staff of people, including Ralph Leach and a number of others, Dick Youngdahl and so on. Did you feel like that you became aware of those conflicts and tensions right after you went to the New York Fed?
Just barely. You have to remember that I was a junior person.
Yeah.
And I worked on the foreign side of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on Western Europe and then on Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
It took me, I would say perhaps, the better part of a decade to become an influential person at the New York Fed.
Mm-hmm.
I was a small cog in the machinery. However, yes, I became aware of the conflicts between the board and the bank because the moment somebody made a phone call to the board, the supervisor would ask what it was about and what was discussed. That it became, there was a great deal of suspicion, and I sensed that vaguely, and it gradually came to me that it was a power struggle between the New York Fed and the board. I have to admit that almost from the beginning it struck me as being much too personal. It seemed to me that the Federal Reserve policy should be one thing, and that the people concerned should agree on what to do. It struck me as unseemly, because the main thing I got from the New York Fed was how proper everything was, and it was very hierarchical, very proper, very structured, very correct, and this isn't it?
The board sent their young people like Ralph Leach to the New York Fed to observe, and the New York people, the New York traders, they resented that very much, having the board people standing over their shoulder, the board people wanted to intervene all along the term structure and buy and sell long-term treasuries, and I'm sorry, the New York people did, and the board people were there to make sure they didn't do it. So there was a lot of kind of feeling like, well, you know, you're here and sort of looking over my shoulder, and we don't need that sort of, you know, supervision. You don't trust us, and so there was there was tension there.
Yes, sure. No, no. That was clear to me, but I didn't. I was looking at it from a mouse eyes point of view. Sorry, mm-hmm. I just did not
sure.
figure very much in this.
Sure. Did you have friends and? In the domestic side?
My main friends at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York are all people whom you will find in any history of the Federal Reserve. Right? One close friend was Peter Sternlight, a longtime manager of the Federal Open Market Account, who was moving forward in the ranks.
Yes.
My good friend was Alan Holmes, who later became the author and then my co-author of the foreign exchange pamphlets put out by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Yes, I've been able to talk with Peter Sternlight a number of times, and he's still very vigorous and active, and that's wonderful. But unfortunately, by the time I started talking to people, Alan Holmes had already died. What can you tell me about him? Was he in the mold of people like Rosa, or was he just primarily a trader and had that sort of outlook on the world that comes from being a trader of all your life?
Primarily, he was a model Federal Reserve Bank of New York officer. He was a totally discreet, totally competent individual from whom Peter Sternlight surely took a lot of hints. He also was a little bit of a rags-to-riches story, not literally, but figuratively, because he went to a small college in Mississippi, Millsaps College, and he just sort of worked his way up. He never did get a PhD. And but he was just so adaptable and so penetrating and so with it. As a trader, yes, he was, if anything, in the distinction that you drew, he would have been a trader.
Mm-hmm.
But first and foremost, he was just a model Federal Reserve officer. And he was appreciated for that because there were not many people, and you know to this day there are not many people, who can combine penetrating analytical skills, excellent communication skills, very carefully calibrated according to the audience. So you tell nothing if you don't want to tell anything, and you want to tell exactly what you want to tell if it comes to somebody who should know. Excellent communication skills, great analytical abilities, and that combined with self-effacement, that last phrase I'm using is perhaps the most difficult of all, self-effacement, because somebody who has all the other abilities, the analytical ability, the communication skills, the knowledge of the markets, with all those skills, it just seems like impossible to be also self-effacing. And that, it was not given to all of them, you know, but Holmes was the epitome of it. And Sternlight certainly is the same.
Yes.
And some others, for example, Rosa fell short because he wanted to make propaganda for himself.
Who is this? I missed the name.
Rosa. Robert B. Rosa.
But, well, let's talk about him because he had all these analytical qualities and he also felt at home with intellectuals. He was at home in the Eastern Ivy League colleges. As as an individual, people didn't find him, you know, overbearing.
He was not. No. He was a good fellow. You will read in my memoirs that he did me a great favor.
Yeah.
But what I mean is that eventually, the need to go public, to be somebody in the public, perhaps got the better of him, and he started grinding out statements and articles and so on. Milking his experience, but without the necessary time to give it the full scholarly depth, and that, but you know, never mind. Everybody has to make a living. Among other things, the people who have worked for the Federal Reserve face the problem sometimes of making some money, and that also was an issue at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and so Rosa finally made sure that he had enough public stature to get a good job. I can't really blame him for that.
He never was willing to accept the board view on bills only, and for that reason, a couple people have told me his the possibility for his advancement within the Federal Reserve System was limited. He was possibly a candidate for the presidency of the New York Fed when Sproul resigned, although he was young, but with Martin's opposition, that wasn't possible. Sproul wanted Triber to succeed him, but Martin vetoed that, and so it was Martin who was instrumental in getting Al Hayes appointed, who was a wonderful gentleman, but he didn't have the stature to challenge kind of Martin. So Rosa did make a choice, and you know that choice apparently prevented him from becoming president of the New York Fed, which would have been an obvious sort of career path for him. I assume he was the protege of Sproul and was eventually on track for that position. Did you know anything about that?
Well, some of this is news to me. It doesn't really surprise me. Mm. But when he took the job in the Kennedy administration, I think that, first of all, he wanted to have more voice in government policy than he had at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And that could be true of many people who have left the New York Fed, because there is a certain amount of frustration involved in the relations with the board, to this day, you know.
Oh, of course.
And then, secondly, I think it became clear to me that Rosa needed money, and that he was using an administration job to take a leap forward in the financial world.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You know, nobody can blame anybody for doing that, really. This is very difficult. I have some friends like Sternlight and Peter Fosek, whom I haven't mentioned yet, mm-hmm. who were a lifetime in the Federal Reserve, and I wasn't willing to do that either. I had three children, and I needed some money to pay college bills.
Yeah.
I didn't go for the big time the way Rosa did, but I can't blame anybody for finally trying to get something out of the service at the Federal Reserve. It's very difficult to remain faithful. It's throughout a career. At any rate, this is a sideline. So I knew Alfred Hayes, Charles Coombs, Robert V. Rosa, Peter Sternlight, Peter Fosek, Paul Volcker, Jerry Corrigan. All of those people are your longtime associates and friends.
I thought Corrigan came much later. I thought he came, 1970 perhaps?
Yes. I got to know him. No, he came earlier than that. He was something like an assistant secretary at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And he was a big fellow whom you couldn't miss in a room, even then. And after that, when I was with the Equitable, I was at the New York Fed quite frequently, and
Okay, well, let's, yeah, I don't want to jump from character to character. Let's stay with Rosa. So when, this is a very interesting period. So Rosa goes to the Treasury. Now, there's a transition between administrations. The Kennedy administration takes the Bretton Woods system just as seriously as the Eisenhower administration did. Everybody I've talked to said Kennedy did not want an international crisis with the gold standard while he was having international crises with the Russians. But the difference was that the Kennedy administration was much more interventionist. And sort of when Rosa came in, then he developed all these, I guess he called them outer defenses, swap lines, and the Fed got involved in foreign exchange intervention, these forms of market intervention that supposedly bought you time so that you didn't have to adjust interest rates because you had, I guess, 7% unemployment when, or at least 6% unemployment when the Kennedy administration began. So in a way, Rosa won. The Fed abandoned the bills only, at least in name, for Operation Twist. Yeah, did you hear any stories about how Rosa convinced Dillon and then convinced Kennedy and Kennedy convinced Martin to go with Operation Twist?
No,
I'm sure they just sat down.
No, that was too high up for me.
Yeah.
But you forgot the exchange stabilization tax, something, the tax on the foreign issue of bonds in this country, or was it the American purchase of foreign bonds? I think it was American purchase of foreign bonds. It was a tax that Rosa proposed.
It was the interest equalization
tax. Interest equalization, yeah.
And Volcker's the one who carried out the details
of
the Treasury.
I know. And I told you already that Volcker was more of an interventionist than you would think from his later very macro-oriented anti-inflation policy. But at any rate, that yes, those were, and you know something, I didn't believe in any of this. I was a junior officer as we were resuming official foreign exchange operations. Things were going well during the Kennedy years because I felt that the domestic policy was backing up the proper use of the swap lines. That is, they were sold as a temporary intervention device to prevent speculation from becoming destabilizing. All of those are loaded terms, as you know. Whether speculation is destabilizing or stabilizing, you can argue until you're blue in your face. But the clear implication was that the intervention that we were undertaking was against the backdrop of taking appropriate domestic measures. The Kennedy administration, I think, would never have stood for the kind of deficits that occurred in later years under Republicans. They would have resisted that strongly. So at any rate, Rosa and Volcker were involved in developing what you call outer defenses, and not successful. Not successful. Operation Twist didn't amount to beans, and you know, I had the feeling right from the start that they didn't really expect it to work. They thought they were working the market psychology.
Well, that was Charlie Coombs's life, which is coordinating central bank intervention to counter market psychology.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he thought the markets were run by psychology and speculative attacks, and you know, a lot of people, that's the world they lived in at the time. This was before the demonstration that floating exchange rates, you know, were not destabilizing. So
yes, well, but I was totally aware right from the start that domestic policy had to back up exchange rate policy. I would write paper after paper in which we were telling Congress these measures that we have taken here are only temporary and they have to be backed up by appropriate domestic policy, and that means proper fiscal and monetary policy. And, you know, most of the time we had to stop short of saying the budget should be balanced and the monetary policy should be capable of imposing higher interest rates. We stopped short of that. But our meaning was 100% clear. From the day I wrote the first paper that was sent by the Treasury to the Congress about the resumption of our official foreign exchange operations, it was 100% clear what we were saying. And it was, in a way, I think that Dylan certainly knew that, and Rosa certainly knew that. They could not conceive of running a domestic policy that would undermine the success of what they judged to be their defenses on the foreign exchange side. They knew that it had to have a proper backup domestically. And this all worked reasonably well, dear friend, until Vietnam.
Well, that's right, but the Kennedy administration was willing to raise interest rates because of the balance of payments problem. In summer of 1963, there was a very carefully negotiated increase in the discount rate for foreign exchange reasons. But the change, and also the administration was willing to raise the ceilings on Regulation Q to make the deposits at New York banks more attractive.
Yes.
And that was a difficult thing politically. But
yes.
all that ended with the Johnson administration, because Johnson was a populist, and between Johnson and Congress, Royce and Patman, neither the administration nor Congress was willing to tolerate an interest rate increase for balance of payments reasons. So the Fed went different, took a different path.
Well, all right, I'm sure that you're right about that, but even before then, the interventionist kind of thing that should have been sort of much, they should have been suspended in favor of market action. For example, the deposit rates were much too low even then. So the deposit regulation Q was already becoming too much of a constraint. And it was obvious that the markets were doing a number on the Federal Reserve with the growth of the commercial paper market and all that, not to speak of the euro market. So all of this was sort of rather obvious to me. I was already beginning to chafe under having bosses who seemed to be like King Canute, you know, commanding the tides to move back.
Well, there was a feeling at the time that the balance of payments problem was primarily structural. That is, when capital markets developed in Europe and there became less of a demand for raising capital in the United States, that the problem would go away. It didn't require significant adjustment on the monetary side. It was a problem that would take care of itself in time. And I don't think the dollar was. If the dollar may have been overvalued in the first part of the 1960s, but not by a lot. As you say, I think it was with domestic inflation in the United States that the system became untenable.
Oh, I'm sure you're right about that. This is just... But if, supposing that you're right with everything that you said,
yeah,
then all the fiddling around would have been excessive, too.
Yeah.
I mean, if there was really a problem that's going to resolve itself sooner or later, why all this fiddling?
Mm-hmm.
The interest equalization tax, I was glad that I'd beaten it out of Washington when Rosa came up with that one. In fact, he never tried that one out on me because I think he knew in advance that I was going to be totally resistant. I was becoming very stubborn because I was an anti-inflationist, and I believed that the proper role of the government could never see a subordinating inflation to growth. And Johnson sent me just through the ceiling. So, because he was a liar, and he never told us the cost of the Vietnam War. He deceived even, well, for Pete's sake, he deceived every Federal Reserve official. He deceived the Treasury. He wouldn't tell the Treasury how much the Defense Department was spending. So with all of that, you know, I heard quite a bit of that later on. Otto Eckstein was a lifelong friend before he died too soon in 85, I think. And so he told me some of the things. It was really terrible. And because of that, I mean, you know, to their credit, Arthur Oaken and then Rosa beat it out of Washington. Oaken beat it out of the administration, and Rosa beat it out of Washington. So they couldn't stand it anymore. But it got worse and worse. And, you know, by the time Nixon took over, and they didn't really know how to cope with any and all of that, and then Bretton Woods collapsed, it was a lesser evil. But an evil it was.
But there were very few people like yourself at that time, almost none. When you think about the people who could have been like that, for example, Henry Wallach and Gottfried Hobbler, they were a mixed bag. They remained interventionist. And to the end of the 1970s, Henry Wallach had these special programs. I think they were called TIPS, where you were going to tax...
You were going to... What a disaster that was.
Yeah, it was a disaster, and the Carter people even tried it, floated it. You were going to tax wage increases above some inflationary level, and Gottfried Hobbler, in the night, I have correspondence from him to Milton Friedman. There was a lively exchange between Friedman and Hobbler in the 1950s about whether inflation was cost pushed from labor unions or whether it was monetary, and again in the same thing in the early 70s. So people like that who had seen the inflations in Germany and Austria and these countries and knew that they were monetary, in the United States they thought it was the labor unions. And so, I mean, how do you account for that? Isn't that like Arthur Burns?
Well, all right, they all were frustrated over the inability or unwillingness of the Federal Reserve to take strong steps on its own. I am convinced that Wallach was frustrated by various Federal Reserve chairmen and various Federal Reserve governors, that he would have given it an honest-to-goodness try even before Volcker did. That would have been his inclination. In my memoirs, I'm telling you a little bit about how this happened intellectually and personally. I'm telling you about the people who were survivors of the Nazi regime and who were survivors of the inflation tales of their parents. And that includes, of course, Wallach and Henry Kaufmann and Alois Nilauer and myself. Those were the people who were, in later years, the inflation hawks. And our views were heavily conditioned by our background. If you read what happened to my family during the Great Inflation, then you'll know why I took that jaundiced point of view of inflation right from the start. I could tell you the stories that happened to me. One day, Ackley, who was then the chairman of the council, he came to New York and he talked to a conference board, and he said, this inflation that they are seeing now, induced by perhaps the sudden pull of aggregate demand, which has put too much of a strain because it came too sudden, but we'll adjust to it and it will, the aggregate the supply will grow correspondingly, blah, blah, blah. He went on like that. So afterwards I went to see him and I said, I hope that you're right about inflation, but you know, if the defense expenditures continue to escalate, you might see really major inflation before aggregate supply ever can catch up. If it does. And he wired at me. He said, what do you think we are? Do you think we are Brazil? Those were his words. Those were his words. And now, who was right? And that, you know, it grates me to this day. And so you know that there were some people who had a perfectly clear view of what might happen unless you took a strong stand on inflation. Now, it is true that in the affairs of men, particularly in a democracy, things have to go fairly wrong before the body politic really starts putting it right. You see a current illustration in the corporate governance issue. There has to be a horror story before you really start taking action. And in the inflation, it may have been the same way, Mr. Edsel. It may be the same thing. But it had to happen in this country before people woke up.
Well, getting back to Ackley, Ackley had the idea that government would, you could get politicians to undertake a program of aggregate demand management, raise taxes, lower taxes, and control aggregate demand. That was the Keynesian agenda, and he believed in it. He believed that it was possible that the politicians, that Congress, that the administration, that President Johnson, that Wilbur Mills, that they would listen to people like him, and that they would raise taxes when they needed to constrain aggregate demand. They lowered taxes in 1964 to stimulate aggregate demand, and that was going to be his legacy, that that he was going to show that there was a symmetry there. That was what all the Keynesians believed, that government would behave that way.
You are right, and I think that they should get credit for that. The Johnson Council of Economic Advisers should get credit because behind the closed doors they told him all about it.
Yeah.
It goes back perhaps to the fundamental question of what you do when you have a basic nature of policy disagreement in Washington. There are not enough people who resign when such a thing occurs. Secretary of State Vance, who resigned over the attack on Iran when the prisoners were held at the American Embassy in Tehran, he is one of the rare exceptions of a guy who actually quit because he disagreed with the policy. Now, the Johnson Council of Economic Advisers could have had a tremendous effect if they had resigned en masse. That would have been a real turning point. I think that many people in Congress were ready to say that you have to pay for the war, and it wasn't done. And that, you know, sort of clinging to power and going along with what you don't believe in is perhaps the major problem of Washington policy. It makes me so cynical to see that illustration over and over again. But at any rate, it isn't, you know, this has not been an issue with the Federal Reserve in recent years. They have had their way, and their way has been correct. So there hasn't been any big problem there, but there continues to be a problem in general of people who know that something is terribly wrong, have a strongly held contrary view, and simply are overruled, and then they sit back and perhaps they leak it to the press, but that's about the extent of what they're willing to do. Now that's, you know, that's not really the straightforward course. The straightforward course is to beat it out of there. And if you are influential enough to make a statement to that effect. Now this is a lot to expect, I know. So anyway, it's a side comment. It reveals perhaps more than I should about where I come from, but at least it's straightforward, so you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Ackley, yes, sure, Ackley was, you know, he gets a lot of credit. I mean, he was a good egg in many ways, but the story I told you illustrates that he could not conceive that no matter how much he loused it up and how much Johnson loused it up, that we could have something that would be a major inflation. He could not conceive of that.
Yeah.
That, of course, was an American conceit. I mean, everybody until the late 1970s thought, oh, we are immune from that. And they had to push their nose into it to find out that the people who came from the old country that issued the warnings were right.
Okay, let's go back to the Eisenhower administration. Do you feel like the Eisenhower administration responded appropriately to the outflows of gold? Did they get it right under Anderson?
Well, that was, again, a little bit before I became very conscious of policy issues, but the Bretton Woods system was being undermined by the recovery of Europe and their underlying distrust of their own strength, so that the gold under the mattress became the refuge for the French peasant again, and that of course was a serious problem for the Bretton Woods system. It's a moot point whether this could have been renegotiated so that you would have had a mutually satisfactory arrangement of international reserve necessities as world the economy expanded without giving ground on the gold price. That this is it's a terribly difficult subject. So, at any rate, I don't believe that the Eisenhower people thought that they were going to have a major dollar problem, a dollar crisis. It's sort of inconceivable to them. You know, Europe was still mired in the mud, and Asia hadn't done a thing. And so I don't believe that they took that as a major policy problem. Actually, you know, Rosa and Kennedy were much more conscious of that as a major problem. And that's why we got back into the foreign exchange operations. The original idea, I think, was to protect the U.S. gold stock.
Did you at some point become an advocate of floating exchange rates?
Yes.
When?
It happened when I saw that I was butting my head against the wall with the Johnson people about the government deficit and the financing of the Vietnam War. Having said from the beginning that appropriate domestic policy was necessary to bolster the foreign exchange regime that we were supposed to maintain with the manipulation of exchange rates through those open market operations, having maintained that from the beginning, I saw that if I couldn't have it done that way, then there was no use trying to maintain the dollar. And so yes, by the early 1970s, I saw it as a lesser evil to abandon the fixed dollar rate.
But so that came pretty close to the August 15th Camp David decision to close the gold window.
Yes. Yes, by that time, I was not unsympathetic to the Nixon administration decision.
Do you remember, and this is something which I kind of would like to get more of a record of, through the 1960s, there was still very vivid in the minds of the average kind of person in Washington and the average policymaker, the idea that foreign exchange rate volatility and manipulations and instability had contributed to the difficulties of the Great Depression, and policymakers thought that the Bretton Woods system, which would prevent unilateral depreciations, would keep that monetary instability from arising again, and they associated floating exchange rates with that sort of instability. That is, these competitive depreciations in the minds of the policymakers became kind of very much identified with the idea that, well, if a country lets its currency float, it's going to depreciate it, and that'll cause all kinds of problems. And so there was enormous resistance. I mean, it was almost inconceivable in the 1960s that you know, the United States would advocate a floating exchange rate system. Do you remember some of that attitude?
Sure.
And
correct. I mean, I thought that it was the proper attitude. That is backed up by the domestic policy. That was the logical consequence of that. I mean, in a fixed exchange rate system, domestic policy has to be adjusted more, and external policy less, by definition. So I said that we would have to act domestically to back up our foreign exchange views, which were that a stable dollar was good for us, ourselves and the world.
What about the attitudes of someone like Charlie Coombs? We talked about him a little bit, but what can you tell me about his relationship with the New York Fed and the board and the Treasury and his attitudes?
Well, he was a pretty complex personality, but underneath it all, he was a CIA-type operator. He was a discreet spy who had the national interest of the United States, which he thought he knew exactly what it was. He had at heart, and he was willing to do almost anything in order to achieve those objectives. He was a true operator. Whether he was a CIA station chief or what he was, in Greece before he came back after. This is now somewhere in the late 40s, early 50s. And he helped contain the communists in Greece. That became a defining moment. Of course he was a strong anti-communist, but it also became a defining moment in how he thought you could get things done. He was a model of discretion. Good judgment and ruthlessness in the pursuit of his objectives, and he was more international policy minded than anybody else at the Federal Reserve at the time. But he also was very much aware of that it was going to be his path to glory. When the German foreign exchange operator, Turmler was his name, outlined to him how you could intervene in the exchanges and that he could provide a swap line to the U.S. so we would have DMs to operate with, because, you know, Coombs was asking himself, how in the hell do I get the resources to operate? If I want to do the same thing that they do with respect to their exchange rates. First of all, he was encouraged by the Germans to try it. And secondly, they were willing to provide those swap lines. Plus, they said, you have the exchange stabilization fund of the Treasury. So he got the idea, and he brilliantly carried that forward, that idea. Of course, with the full cooperation and understanding of Robert V. Rosa.
Well, tell me, what was the name of the German you mentioned?
His name was Turmler. Turmler.
And
he was the vice president of the Bundesbank in charge of foreign exchange.
And so Rosa and Coombs were close because of the New York Fed connection?
Yes. Well, they had grown up in the ranks together. Rosa was ahead of Coombs. But once Rosa went to Washington, Coombs became his counterpart. In my little story, I tell you a little bit something, perhaps not enough, about the relationships that existed when the Treasury and the Federal Reserve were trying to cooperate in the resumed foreign exchange operations. This, of course, is not so easy to this day, you know.
Yes.
But as this started out, Rosa, who by then was a federal government official, was asserting the supremacy of the political arm, and Coombs was, and Alfred Hayes and William McChesney Martin were trying to assert the supremacy of the technical arm to carry out a technical operation. You know what I mean? Coombs and his associates were trying to make this look like you have to be a really good foreign exchange man and know the markets in order to know what you're doing. And Rosa and Dillon were saying, buzz off. This is you're intruding on foreign policy territory. And we know best what to do. And plus the fact that they control the exchange stabilization fund, whereas the Federal Reserve had to get its resources from those swap lines, you know?
Well, but I'm going to send you an article on this that I wrote, where I go back and read the minutes and talk about the debates at the time. But ultimately, it was the Treasury that needed the Fed, because the Foreign Exchange Stabilization Fund had its money tied up with loans to South American countries, and it was the ability to create dollars in limitless amounts that gave you the ability to intervene in foreign exchange markets, so that it was the Treasury that needed the Fed.
Well, you see, they needed each other.
Yeah.
The Treasury certainly needed the Federal Reserve expertise. The year that I spent in Washington was really being the liaison between Rosa and Coombs. And before that, we had, Alan Holmes had that job first. And then there was another man who had that job, Merle Truitt, and then I got it. And then after I left in 63, Merle Truitt, who was then an assistant vice president of the New York Fed, was called back. That could be put out for longer terms. The swaps were supposed to be liquidated very quickly, you know?
Right.
So it was not as if, plus the fact that at least in my time, the Federal Reserve did not really want to push the relationship to the breaking point. Nobody wanted to have another confrontation like the Accord.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you've told me two somewhat different things. You said there was a rivalry and a tension between the Fed and the Treasury, where, I mean, all treasuries assert that foreign exchange intervention deals with foreign affairs and therefore is the province of the Treasury. On the other hand, central banks they want the prestige of the central bank. And they need the ability of the central bank to create the dollars that can be used in the swap lines to borrow the foreign currencies. The Foreign Exchange Stabilization Fund didn't have that much in the way of free resources. So there's this tension. On the other hand, you told me, you know, Coombs and Rosa were very close, and
they were close like brothers. You know, they fight like brothers. They had a common front when it came to anybody who wanted to say, quit that fiddling around.
Mm-hmm.
Then if Milton Friedman had walked in there and said, you're all wet, just let the foreign exchange rates float, they would have immediately closed ranks.
Mm-hmm.
They were all one mind on that. There's no contradiction at all. But when it came to who has what rights, they were fighting like brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And the foreign exchange consultant from the New York Fed at the Treasury, somehow, I was the errand boy who ran delivering messages back and forth that everybody knew were loaded. I can remember arguing with the Treasury man who sat in the same office that the Treasury, among other things, made me sit in the same office with a Treasury official who was supposed to know exactly what I was doing and who was supposed to learn enough so that they wouldn't need another consultant from the New York Fed. So later they solved that problem by appointing a deputy assistant secretary from the New York Fed, as I mentioned to you. But in the meantime, this fellow, Watson. He was supposed to spy on me, but work with me, cooperative, so that we would do exactly the same thing. So I remember arguing with him. I say, the New York Fed seems to be on the point of wanting to hold the DM dollar line at this point, and I think that the Bundesbank has encouraged them to do that. So he says to me, well, you have to tell Rosa immediately. I say, well, now, wait just a moment. I was told that confidentially by the operator in the New York Fed, and we are not really sure that the Germans mean what they say, and they have to clarify this some more. You have to tell them immediately. So this is the kind of atmosphere that prevailed. That's, you know, at my level.
Hmm.
But at their level, well, they would very politely say who should call that or the foreign treasury man or the foreign central bank official, and they would, they would try to avoid direct confrontations.
Did you have any contact with Paul Volcker at this time at the Treasury?
Now, the timing of this is a little bit off. I think that Volcker was at the Chase at that time.
He was
time.
At Chase, okay.
Yes, he came to the Treasury with the Nixon people.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think during the Kennedy time, I think Volcker was either at the New York Fed or at the Chase.
Well, he was at Chase in the late 50s, and then he went to the Treasury with the Kennedy people, and he stayed until fall of 1965, and then he went to Chase, and then he came back in with the Kennedy people.
Nixon.
I'm sorry, yeah, the Nixon people.
No, I know. Then if he was already there, I had no contact with him. He was on the domestic side, probably.
Yes, and domestic debt management, but apparently he was involved in the international too, because he wrote the regulations for the interest equalization tax.
Oh, I see. No, I didn't have any contact with him at the Treasury. I was back at the New York Fed by that time. I was at the Treasury only a year.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that's right. Now it comes back to me. Yes, he was at the Treasury then, and that. Well, I got out of the Federal Reserve then in 66 and went with the Equitable. And I'm telling you of what I was doing at the New York Fed after I got back from the Treasury, too, in my memoirs. You'll see that.
Okay.
But
well, I'm wondering if we shouldn't